This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
About the relationship and interdependence of the moral and ethical part of the Torah with the ritual part of the Torah, what they call the ritual part of the Torah. And of course the secular humanists argue that one can be an ethical person, one can be a moral person without keeping the ritual, that one does not have to be a good Jew to be a good human being. And in true Torah thought, we argue that that isn't so, that the levels of morality required by the Torah cannot be attained without participating in all of the beliefs of the Torah and in all of the practices of the Torah. And then we have the other extreme, I suppose, although it's not argued officially that way, but certainly conduct and belief seems to project that belief, the other extreme. And that is, unlike the humanists who say you don't have to be a good Jew to be a good human being, we unfortunately have people who seem to say you don't have to be a good human being to be a good Jew. You can be a good Jew without being a good human being. You can be deceitful and you can steal and you can cheat and you can do all sorts of terrible things. You can talk Lashon Hora. You can be a Baal Machlokes and you can still be a good Jew. So as unacceptable as the view of the humanists is on the one side, that you can be a good human being without being a good Jew, it's equally unacceptable to believe that you can be a good Jew without being a good human being. And the uniqueness of the Torah, we don't see it as quite so unique, because Christianity tried to some degree to project the same philosophy, of course, based on the Torah, and in some funny degree Islam as well, also based on the Torah. But yet they deviated, and perhaps that was the main deviation that Christianity brought into the field in its day, was the removal of much of the ritual. Almost an acceptance of the humanist approach, that we can cut aside a lot of the ritual and just leave the humanistic side of the Torah. In the Torah, in Torah thought, of course, we don't accept that, and we find an inextricable interdependence between the moral part of Torah and the ritual side part of Torah. And it's necessary for us, in fact, when we're learning the different parts of Torah, to perceive the common thread that runs through them all. Otherwise we aren't really grasping the whole of Torah. And this principle is clearly stated in the famous Chazal, where the convert comes to Shammai and says he wants to convert, provided Shammai can give him one principle that he can grasp while he stands on one leg, which will guide him through life, a Torah principle which incorporates the whole of Torah. And Shammai doesn't accept the challenge. He says it's impossible. And he then goes to Hillel, you remember, and Hillel says, don't do to others what you wouldn't then want done to yourself. Zeh kol ha-Torah kulo. That's the whole Torah and the rest of Perushim. That means that in that statement lies the essence of the whole Torah. And whether we're looking at the ethical laws of that, not stealing and not being deceitful and not coveting things that aren't one's own, or we're looking at the ritual laws, Shabbos and Kashrus and sacrifices, there is one underlying principle that governs them all, and that is human nobility. That is, through the Torah one achieves human nobility, which Chazal express also in the statement of Lo Nisno Torah, Elo Nisno Mitzvahis Elo Vatzarech Bohenes Abrius. That mitzvahs were given for the sole purpose of refining the human being, of refining humanity, of ennobling human nature. That is the purpose. And therefore we have to find in all of Torah some kind of expression of that common denominator, of that common thread and that common principle which runs through the entire Torah. And we're starting at the beginning of Sefer Vayikra. That's where we tend to find most difficulty in that area. The book of Vayikra deals with sacrifices. And there is no area more ritualistic, if we use that word, as much as I dislike it, I can't think of a better word. There is no part of Torah more ritualistic than the section of sacrifices, of korbanos. And yet, even in korbanos, we need to find a relationship between the korban and the ethics of the human being. So we find some of it in the symbolism of the korbanos, which Shimshon Raphael Hirsch deals with to a large extent, what the korban represents, what the animal represents, the different kinds of korbanos and how we relate to them and identify with them. We see some kind of symbolic interrelatedness with the ethical side of the Torah. But in the halachas of the korban, we need to find it too. And what we're going to do this evening is an expansion on last night's drasha, whereby we're going to examine the relationship between the most fundamental of all ethical principles and the most fundamental of all ritual principles. The most fundamental of all ritual principles is the korban. There's nothing more ritualistic than the sacrifice. And among the sacrifices, there is no sacrifice more purely ritualistic than the korban oilah. Because the other korbanos served as meals. People ate them. Sometimes the owner ate them, sometimes the kohanim ate them, but they were basically braais, barbecues, with a special religious significance to them. But the oilah couldn't possibly be seen that way. The oilah was no braai, that was no barbecue, because nobody ate it. So it was purely ritualistic. So the most extreme case in the entire Torah of a ritual is the korban oilah. The most extreme ethical principle in the Torah, something which is most fundamental and most simply ethical and on the surface apparently not linked to anything ritualistic in the Torah, is the prohibition of theft. That every society understands, every person understands, no matter whether it's religious, any religion, not religious, atheistic, agnostic, whatever he wants to be. One thing everybody understands is that you can't have a society in which there's theft. And we're going to find that Chazal link those two together, even the most extreme of ethical principles, of secular ethical principles, if we can call it that way, with the most extreme of religious ritual principles. Chazal find a linkage, and if the linkage exists in these two, then we can realize that that linkage must exist in every single ritual and ethical halacha that there is in the Torah. You remember the story of Bilam. Hashem comes across him and he's busy building altars. All of a sudden, become a tzaddik, he's building altars. Amalei says to him, Rosh Hashanah Toisa. Hashem says to Bilam, you wicked man, what are you doing? This is in the opening Tanchuma from this week's Sedra. What are you doing? Amalei Shivat HaMizbochis Orachti. I've prepared already 7 Mizbechis. Don't worry, Hashem, I'm doing my duty. 7 altars I've already built. What can that be compared to? The Tabach Sheyomecher B'Shuk. Like a butcher who was selling in the marketplace. And his shop was full of meat. And the tax collector came and he starts looking around at the meat, trying to estimate how much he should take in taxes. The butcher saw what the way the tax collector was looking. She didn't have to come here. I've already sent a whole lot of meat to your home with the messenger boy. You go home, you'll find it all there. You've got nothing to do here. I've already done it all. So too, Hashem says to Bilam, what are you doing here? What's going on? And Bilam gets scared and he says, I've already brought sacrifices, Hashem. Don't worry, I've brought my sacrifices. Do you think I get impressed with sacrifices? I'll give anything. You want me to give my firstborn? I'll sacrifice anything you want. If I wanted sacrifices, I would have asked my angels, Michael and Gavriel, they would have brought sacrifices. I don't need you to bring these sacrifices. Are you trying to fool yourself into thinking that I might accept a sacrifice from one of the other nations of the world? That's out of the question. I've made a deal with the Jewish people. There's only one nation I accept sacrifices from, and that's from Am Yisrael, not from anybody else. I don't need your sacrifices. Therefore, in the beginning of the Seder, it says, instruct Aharon and his son, saying, they are the ones to bring korbanos. There's nobody else who has the authority and the ability to be able to bring a korban. This can only be brought by Aharon and descendants of Aharon. Those are the only sacrifices I'm going to accept, says the Ribbono Shel Olam. So there's now something unique about the Jewish people enabling them to bring sacrifices. What do the Jews have that give them that special authority, that special ability to bring a korban that we don't have? What is it? Amar Lehem HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem answers, as the first sentence of the parasha goes on to say, Zois Teiras Ha'ila. This is the Torah, these are the laws of the Oila, of the burnt offering. Umi Zois Oila Min Habid Midbar. And says the Medrash, what does this Oila mean? The word has been used elsewhere, in Shir HaShirim. Who is this coming up from the desert? Who is this? Am Yisrael. So the word used for the primary korban, the korban Oila, is the same word used to describe the Jewish people. So there's a certain poetic imagery used here. The Oila, the coming up of the offering, and the coming up of the Jewish people out of the desert. Moshe Olo El Ha'elokim, and Moshe went up to Hashem. So the Medrash implies here that from the word Oila, we see that it's not only the sacrifice that goes up, but it's brought by the nation able to raise itself above its environment. A nation able to raise itself to the levels of godliness. From the desert, from the Midbar, able to raise itself up to the highest levels. Those are the ones who are capable of bringing a korban, not the other nations. The other nations are established at certain levels and they continue to function at those levels. The Jewish people are established at a certain level and they raise themselves higher and higher. There is no limit to the levels that they can raise themselves if they choose to do so, if they're willing to do so, and if they set about doing so. And that's the Korban Oila. The Korban Oila is God's answer to the other nations as to why the Jewish people are able to bring a Korban Oila, because they're able to be Oilim, they're able to raise themselves, they've been given the means and the mechanisms of raising themselves. And we've often discussed that is the point at which a non-Jew is obligated to convert to Judaism. If he feels that he is no longer satisfied with the level at which he is as a member of his nation, and he wants to raise himself, that's what becoming Jewish means. I want the ability, I want mitzvahs that will enable me to lift myself to higher levels. That means you want to be Jewish, good, fine, then you convert. And what is that raising? We have another pasuk, which the Medrash brings a little bit further down. Mi ya'ale b'har Hashem u'mi yokum b'mkom kodesho. That same word, Yale, who is it who can go up on Hashem's mountain? And who can stand there? This ability to raise oneself. To raise oneself. What is it dependent upon? Who is the person? Who is the individual able to rise up onto the mountain of Hashem and to stand up there? Who is it? Says David HaMelech. Neki chapayim uval levav. It's somebody with clean hands. Somebody who hasn't stolen. And here again, we're beginning to see the correlation between the religious part of the Torah, perhaps not the ritualistic part yet, but the religious part of the Torah and this ethical part of the Torah. Who is it that can approach God? Who is it that can come close to the Ribbono Shel Olam? And the Ki Chapayim, somebody whose hands are clean. And we see that concept expressed in the Medrash itself. For the Medrash says, Vayedaber Hashem Tzavis Aaron Desbonov. If you take the opening sentence of this week's parsha, and Hashem said, command Aaron and his sons, Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Kiyumu Mashakosuv L'malo Min Ho'inyan. First, see that you have fulfilled what is recorded in the Torah before this verse. V'achakach Zois Torah So'ilo, and then you can bring a korban oila. And what is it that comes just before this verse? The sacrifice that a person has to bring if he's accused of stealing something given to him in trust, and he denies that it's been given to him in trust, he's stolen it, afterwards it's found that it was true that he did steal it, then he has to bring a korban osha. So says the Medrash, make sure that you have kept what comes before. What comes before is the korban for theft, and then you can bring a korban oil. Lama, why? And the Medrash brings a verse from Yeshayahu, Ki ani Hashem oyhev mishpot, soyne gez gazel ba'oila. For I am Hashem who loves justice and despises theft in a sacrifice, in a korban oila. Afilu b'oila, that means even when you're bringing a korban oila, I don't want there to be any theft. In bikashto lakriv korban, if you want to bring a sacrifice, the Medrash sums up, lo sigzol lo odom klum. Make sure you've never stolen a thing from another human being. Not just that the sacrifice is not stolen. Theft is a funny thing. It's not like other averas. If a person performs another avera, chas v'sholem, that avera is defined. It's limited. He did it, and that's it. He can somehow limit it. But if a person steals 10 cents, or 1 cent for that matter, that 1 cent can no longer be identified. It's not there's the 1 cent that he stole. It means that in all of his assets there is a very small portion of theft, because it all becomes part of one's estate. It's not identifiable. If I lend you 100 rand, you can't come along and show me which 100 rand it is. If I invest in a public company and then I come along and say, I've got a share in the company, is that true? They say yes. And I say, how much is my share? They say, well, how many have you got? I say, I've got 100 shares. Or they say, that's a millionth of the company. I say, fine, I want to know which million. Show me, where? Which is mine? What part of this is mine? In every part of the company you have a millionth. That's how it is with money. It's not that there's an identifiable part. In every part you have a share. And if there is gezel, that means even if it's 1 cent theft, in everything that one has, there is a portion of theft. It infiltrates into absolute everything. That's why in the time of the flood, Hashem destroyed the world. Not for any other things they did. They did lots of terrible things, but the reason he destroyed them was for theft. Because once the world is full of theft, you can't undo it. You can't unravel it. It becomes so complex. There's theft in everything. You can't just... And that's why the animals had to die and property had to go. Everything had to be destroyed. Because you couldn't isolate and say, that's stolen and that's stolen and that's stolen. Everything's stolen. There is a portion of theft in everything once there's theft in anything. And therefore says the Medrash, in Bikashta Lakriv Korbon, Lo Sigzoil Lo Odom Klum. There is a precondition for the bringing of a sacrifice. And that is that you've never stolen a penny from anybody. There's no religion that you'll find that. Where the condition for the ritual is the ethics. That there cannot be a beginning of the ritual unless there's perfection in the ethics. Not just ethics, but perfection. Le'sigzol le'odom klum. You shall have stolen absolutely nothing from anybody. What does it mean to have stolen absolutely nothing from anybody? What is gezel? Gezel is to possess any asset which, according to the laws of the Choshen Mishpat, according to the laws of the Shulchan Aruch, you have no right to possess. That's what it means. So let me give you an example. You put your house on the market, you have to sell the house, and you're desperate. The building society, you can't pay your building society bond, chas v'sholom, can't manage the repayments. The market is low. Times are difficult, you've just lost a job, and you've got nothing, and you've got to sell the house, and you've got to get back at least as much as you paid for the house, maybe a little bit less because you've already paid off a small amount of it. So let us say you paid 200,000 rand for your house, and you've been paying off a little bit, so you've got to get at least 180,000 rand, otherwise you're in real trouble. You put the house on the market, and put it on the market, you have one show house after the other, no show, nothing happened. Wait another few months, market's no better, you try again. What do? Before you put it on the market this time, the agent comes in and says, you know, the house is looking schmatty. So, fine, there's nothing wrong, paint it up before you put it on the market, nothing wrong with that. But there's a crack in one of the rooms and you wallpaper the room. And there's damp at the bottom of one of the rooms, so you fix up the plaster there and you paint it up. Everybody does it. And somebody comes in and offers you 180,000 rand for the house, so you're happy. But had they seen the crack and had they seen the damp, what would they have offered? Maybe 130,000 rand, maybe 140,000 rand. Alpi Shulchan Aruch, according to the Shulchan Aruch, the balance is not yours. You have no right to it. Because there's a difference between presenting and displaying your merchandise to its maximum advantage, which is fully acceptable. It's quite in order for a merchant to show his merchandise off to maximum advantage, to show it in the best light, and to show it in the nicest way. Nothing wrong with it. But to hide deficiencies, that's gezeila. We're not allowed to hide deficiencies. We've got to show what the deficiencies are. And it's amazing how, in fact, I find with my customers, and I'm sure it's in all areas of business, is more effort is put into hiding deficiencies than into displaying to maximum advantage. If you display a thing to maximum advantage, you can very often get away with showing the deficiencies. Because what happens? I'm just showing you that it's good business as well, it's not just good ethics. When you display something to good advantage, the buyer falls in love with it. He likes it. Once a person's fallen in love, he tolerates deficiencies. It's exactly the same as in life. When a man and a woman have fallen in love, and you say to the guy, but don't you see that she's not for you? And he doesn't see anything. He's in love. The deficiencies, and you tell him about the deficiencies. And she says to him, you know, I don't think I'm for you. I'm aggressive and I'm mean and I'm nasty. He says, but I love you. And he says, but I don't think I'm for you. You know what I am. You know what a so-and-so I am. She says, I can put up with you for the rest of you. There's so many good things for the rest of my life I can put up with you. It doesn't last very long afterwards, but at the time, they're in love and that's fine. Why? They displayed, they haven't hidden their deficiencies from one another. They fell in love first. That's why there's an interesting shaila in halacha actually. What do you do if there's skeletons in a cupboard and a shidduch trying to be organized? The person who has a problematic background, maybe an inherited disease or the family has, whatever it is, does he or she have to reveal it before he or she goes out on their first date? Or what? What do you do? So I've heard some rabbis who say, of course you've got to. Before you go on the first date, you've got to make it clear to the shadchan, and must tell the other party. It's all very fine, but you should know my father's got a hereditary disease and my mother's got a hereditary disease. They both died from it. My grandparents died from it. All my brothers and sisters have died from it. The doctor says, I don't have terribly much to go, but apart from that, everything's fine. So some rabbis will say, you've got to say that. I've seen some rabbis who've said, under the chuppah, just before he gives her the ring, somebody must whisper the truth so that he doesn't do it. Yes, I've actually heard that. I've actually heard that. And of course, neither of them are correct. If a person reveals his deficiency before there's an emotional bond, the person will never get married. And to go under the chuppah and reveal it just under the chuppah, that's also not fair. But what the correct approach is that the two can meet each other, and once they've met each other one or two times, and there's some kind of an attachment, then you say, but I've got something to tell you before we go any further. These are the problems. And then the person is in a position to say, yes, I understand those problems, but there's so many things that I'm attracted to about you that I'm prepared to overlook the problems. But there has to be that dynamic first before you can start looking at the problems. So the merchant is very worried. If the customer sees the problem, sees the deficiencies, he won't buy the merchandise. So he hides the deficiencies. It's not necessary. All you have to do is you have to display the goods to maximum advantage. And there are lots of slight, sophisticated little chokhmas in doing that. And each trade knows how to display their particular merchandise to maximum advantage. And then once the buyer has feels an attachment, then you can say, that you need to know. This is the problem. However, because of this problem, you're getting a good price. Or because of this problem, you're getting much more of the article than you would otherwise. There are advantages to it as well. By that time, the person feels an attachment and says, okay, I can live with that, the deficiency I can live with. So it's very important to be able to do that. But to hide the cracks and to hide the deficiencies, that's gezel. That's theft. That means you're taking something, you're taking money, which doesn't belong to you. So when the Medrash says a person has never loigozo mi odom klum, that before he brings a korban, in bikashto lahakriv korban, if you want to bring a korban, loisigzo odom klum, make sure that you've never stolen anything from anybody. That doesn't mean that you haven't put your hands into his till. That means that you haven't taken anything which according to the laws of Chosh and Mishpat you're not allowed to take. How many Jews know the laws of Chosh and Mishpat? How many businessmen have studied the laws of Chosh and Mishpat? How many from people? How many B'nai Torah have studied the laws, never mind understand them, know them, have examined how to practice them, have conquered the Yetzer Hara in dealing with them, never mind all that. Just knowledge. What do we do? Would we go into a Shabbos without knowing something about the laws of Shabbos? When a person becomes a Baal Tshuva, knows every week a Shabbos comes around. He wants to know what he's allowed to do, what he isn't allowed to do. So if you advertise there's a law, there's a shir on Hilchah Shabbos, he comes, he needs to know what Hilchah Shabbos is. A shir on Kashrus, he needs to know how to keep a kosher kitchen, he comes. If you say there's a shir on Chosh and Mishpat, not so well attended. Well, it's complicated, it's difficult, it's hard, it's not so practical. You hear people saying sometimes also not so practical, which I can never understand. Shabbos is practical once a week. Chosh and Mishpat is practical every day of the week except Shabbos. So what's more important, to know how to be a Jew for 6 days a week or to know how to be a Jew for 1 day a week? Really, it's much more important to know the laws of business. This one has to know. Because without that, you don't know whether you're stealing or not. You don't know what the principles are. Questions of negotiation. What is acceptable? On the one hand, if somebody comes to you, you're making an offer on a house, back to the house example, and you look at the house and you figure he's asking $500,000 for the house, but he knows he's not going to get $500,000. So you're going to offer $400,000, but you know he's not going to accept $400,000, but at least you can start negotiating. So you say $400,000, he says jump in the lake. So you say, no. So what will you accept? He says, I'm asking 500. He says, come, forget the 500,000. He says, make me a serious offer and we'll talk. But not with this 400,000 nonsense. So you offer 420. So he says, look, 420 is out. 460 I'll consider. So you say, look, that's out of the question. 420 is out. 425, and that's my last offer. He says, do you really mean that? Is that your best offer? But you know you're willing to go up to 450. There's a Torah. Now he comes along and says, 425, is that your best offer? What are you supposed to say now? Actually not. It's just for playing, for negotiation. I'm really willing to go up to 450, but I didn't want to say that because that's clearly not what you have to do. What about telling lies? So there are halachas. These things have to be analyzed and discussed. What can you do and what can't you do? How far can you go and how far can't you go? At what point is it sheker and deceit and theft? And at what point is this normal business practice? In bikashto lahakriv korban, you want to bring a sacrifice, lo sigzo lo odom klum, no theft at all, nothing at all. Very difficult. How difficult is it not to steal? Even straight out things that are wrong. There's the amazing story, you remember, that the Yeshua and his people came and conquered Yericho, and they declared a cherem. Hashem told them to declare a cherem that nobody could benefit from Yericho at all. It had to be burnt and left and destroyed. Nobody could take anything from Yericho. And Ochan took something. And as a result of that, when they tried to attack the next city, Ai, they suffered a terrible defeat. They go to Hashem, they cry, what's happening? We don't know why we're suffering a defeat. Hashem says, because there are people among you who have done wrong. They don't know who it is, so they draw lots, and the lot comes out on Ochan. Vayomer Yeshua el Ochon. Yeshua says to Ochon, "Bni simno chovid laHashem elokei Yisrael. Grant honor now to Hashem, the God of Israel. V'sen loy soido and acknowledge him. V'hagev no li me osiso altachachem mimeni and tell me what you did. Don't hide it from me. Now don't forget the consequence of Ochon's deeds is a death sentence. So Moshe is saying to Ochon, Yeshua is saying to Ochon, own up. And you're going to have to die for it. There's no special compensation for owning up. We can't make a deal with the state prosecutor here. You're going to own up and you're going to have to die for it. But please, own up. That's the right thing to do. Who is Ochon? Reb Simcha Zissel mentions that the second paragraph of Aleinu starts Al Kein Nekove Lecho Ayin Chof Nun. That's Ochon. The first three words. Because he composed that second paragraph of Aleinu, which we say three times a day till this day. That's Ochon. Look at what a person Ochon was. Ochon composed that second paragraph of Aleinu. And later on, when Ochon is given the death sentence, Yeshua says, you have made us ugly, may Hashem make you ugly this day. And Chazal say, Bayom Hazeh, but not Olam Habo. Yes, he gets the death sentence, but he gets his Olam Habo. He was a tzaddik. This is the only thing wrong that he did. And what happened? When he owns up, what does he say? What actually happened? And he says the most amazing thing. Vayan Ochon is Yeshua. And Ochon answers Yeshua and he says, Om no anachi chatosi la Hashem elokei Yisrael. V'chazos asisi. I have sinned and I've done the following. Va'ere basholol adere shinor achach toivo. I saw among the spoil of Yericho a beautiful fur coat, umasayim shkolim kesef and 200 shkolim of silver, veloshim zov and a piece of gold echod, one of them chamishim shkolim mishkolo weighing 50 shekel, vo ech medeim vo ekochem, and I desired them and I took them, knowing that there was a death sentence attached to that. Ochon, the author of the second paragraph of Aleinu, a man who's guaranteed a place in Olam Haba, a tzaddik. Would we believe such a thing of one of our Gedolei Yisrael in this generation? That such a thing would happen? That a Gedolei Yisrael, Chas V'Sholom, would have to own up to having stolen a fur coat and a bit of silver and gold? Would we accept it? We don't understand these things. But we see from here what that Chemdas HaMomen is. What it is for a person to actually fall in love with material things to the point where he cannot withhold himself from it even when he knows it's absolutely wrong and the consequence is death in the case of Ochon. So we're not dealing in there, we're talking about out and out unacceptable behavior. This is not just presenting your goods in such a way that the defects are masked, which is normal business practice, although it's ethically totally unacceptable and halachically totally unacceptable. We're not talking about subtleties. We're talking about taking an object which Hashem has said, thou shalt not take, and if thou dost so, thou shalt be killed. Absolute clarity about it. It's not subtle at all. And Ochron couldn't withstand the temptation. The great Ochron, who had lived through the desert, who'd seen the miracles, who'd been eating man. Think of who this Ochron is. And he can't withstand the temptation of taking something which doesn't belong to him. That's what gezeilah is. That's the temptation of gezeilah, of acquiring assets which are pi halacha are not entitled to be ours. Why is it so hard? The reason that it's so hard is because Hashem obligates us to exercise the will. I'm going to say a strange, this is a strange phrase, but I'll explain it after I've said it, so please don't fall asleep after I've said the phrase and before I've explained it, because you'll misunderstand it. Hashem demands of us on a daily basis to exercise the will to steal and yet not to steal. What does that mean? We believe that our panosa, our income, is miraculous. How we earn a living, that's from the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's not normal and natural. So if Hashem wanted to, he could bring us our income in a normal, in an abnormal way, in a supernatural way. But he doesn't. He requires us to go out and act as if our actions are actually achieving the results. But they're not achieving the results. I've often repeated to you the lovely story that there was a maggid here years ago from Bnei Brak. Rav Galinsky, I think his name was, who told the lovely story of the fisherman. He says, when you go fishing and you catch big fish, you find little fish in their tummies and in their throats, because they've been eating the little fish. He says, but you would expect to find the little fish in their throats with the tail backwards and the head outwards, because the big fish chase the little fish, of course, so they come upon them from the back and they grab them from the back. So you would expect when they swallow them that they swallow them tail first. But when you open up the fish, you find it's not so. You find them swallowed head first. And I've checked up with fishermen, and they tell me it's true. That's exactly how it is. And I've asked the fishermen, how come? They don't know. Never been able to understand it. And Rav Galinsky explained it very simply. He said, sure, the fish go chasing after the little fish, disappearing in front of them, but they never catch them. While they're busy chasing those fish, other fish come swimming right into their mouths. And that's how it is with panosa. We go chasing after deals and running around and we're chasing, but it's not the deals we chase after that come to fruition. While we're busy chasing other deals, the Ribbono Shel Olam brings us all sorts of other things, and that's what works. If we sit at home and we don't do anything, nothing comes. But if we go out and we look for things and we go after our deals and we try to do our business, that business we go after we don't usually get. But all sorts of other things come our way as a result of that. So we can see that it's really... it's really Minashon. Yet we have to go through the motions as if it's ourselves and believe all the time that it's not ourselves. It's like a wood chopper who all day chops wood, and he's supposed to believe that the success he's achieving in splitting the wood has nothing to do with his axe or with his strength. So you give him a blunt axe and you say, try, it doesn't work. You sharpen the axe and it does work. You say, try without much strength, it doesn't work. You say, try hard and it does work. And that's how he functions every day. He knows, sharpen the axe and it works better. When the axe gets blunt, it stops working. Use more effort and it works better. Use less effort, it doesn't work better. He knows that, he sees it. And he's got to believe that it's not koichi v'etzim yodi. He's got to believe it's all miraculous. It's not me, not my chopper. It's the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's how it is with our work. We have to go and we see, you work a bit harder, you do a bit better. You stop working harder, you don't do better. And we've got to believe that our work has nothing to do with our results. What the Ribbono Shel Olam is asking for us, from us, in our work situation, is supernatural. We have to continue on a daily basis exercising the belief, acting as if our effort has results, and believing that our effort doesn't have results. We've got to act contrary to our beliefs. We had a shiur on this a year or two ago. That in this area, unlike any other area of the Torah, our actions actually have to be contrary to our beliefs. Normally you have to act in accordance with your belief. You believe in Hashem and you act according to that belief. You believe in something ethical, in something right, in something moral. You act in accordance with that belief. But here, you believe that your income comes from Hashem, but you go out and act as if it doesn't. So we have to act in an opposite way to our belief. It's an amazing thing. And that's why it's so hard not to steal, not to take something which isn't our own. We see all the time that by doing these things, one gets wealthier. Then they say that crime doesn't pay, and I always say that's not true. It pays very well, as long as you don't get caught. But if you don't get caught, it pays very well to steal. And crime doesn't pay. What nonsense is that? It's a typical example of how a thing becomes a cliche and becomes accepted, and people hear it and repeat it and say it, and it's untrue, it's nonsensical, and it's absurd. Crime pays very well, and it's tax-free on top of it. It has all sorts of side benefits. Of course crime pays. To steal from somebody, it's the easiest way to get money. There's nothing more easy than that. And the proof is how many people are stealing at the moment on all sorts of levels, from the petty thieves and the car thieves to the fancy white-collar fraud that takes place. Of course it pays. Otherwise people wouldn't risk so much to do it if it didn't pay. And we're living in a life and acting on a day-to-day basis where we see normal cause and effect, and we have to act in a different way. We have to have different beliefs. There's often been comments as to why Lithuanian Jewry lived in such terrible poverty, whereas in other parts of Europe the Jews weren't always in such poverty. In some areas they lived in a great deal of wealth, and I think there are many reasons for it. Sometimes some people have said that the reason the Torah flourished in Lithuania is because they were so poor they had nothing else to do, which is a terrible thing to say. And if anything, it's the other way around. The reason they were so poor is because not only did they learn Torah, but they lived by Torah. That their standards of ethics in business were so unbelievable that it was impossible for them really in that kind of climate to make a lot of money. And it isn't always like that. It depends on what kind of economy one's living, but it is very difficult to keep to chosh and mishpat and to do well in business. One has to know that. It is extremely difficult. So one might think, in that case, let me become an employee, let me rather take a job. It's easier. Not easier at all. Don't forget what the requirements are. An employee isn't allowed to stop to say more than the first paragraph of Kriya Shema. He's not allowed to bench properly because of the time that takes, that theft from his balabos. If he takes a moment off that he's not supposed to take, anything like that is already theft as well. So to work in the working environment, whatever you is, whether you're your own balabos or you're working for somebody else, it's equally difficult to function without theft, without taking anything which our pitura doesn't belong to you. How do we handle it? What do we do to overcome that? So here comes the question of attitude and philosophy. The only way to overcome that is to believe and to live according to that belief that nothing is really mine. That everything that I've got or that anybody else has got is given to them in trusteeship and not in ownership. We don't own anything. We're simply given it in trust by the Ribbono Shel Olam to use in certain ways in accordance with guidelines that he set down. But it's not me. Once we take that attitude, it becomes a little bit easier. If we see somebody who's a banker, a bank manager, we don't relate to the bank manager as a multi-millionaire, because in his branch he's got a big huge safe with millions stashed away over there, and he's got enormous amounts of assets invested in all sorts of investments. So the bank manager is a millionaire? Not at all. The bank manager is an ordinary salaried person, probably earning the same or less than the average other person, and that's all that it is. And if the bank manager will steal for the bank, what will we think? It doesn't happen that often. When you hear bank managers involved in fraud, it's not usually on behalf of the bank. It's usually on behalf of themselves. Nobody's going to be such a fool to steal for somebody else. People don't do that kind of thing. People don't steal for others. If you're going to steal already, you want the benefit. You won't find the bank manager stealing for the bank. Very rarely. Why not? If you're only a trustee, there's no chap in stealing. Because the bank not only doesn't the bank want it or need it, the bank will fire you for doing that. The bank won't say thank you very much. The board of directors is not going to promote you because you stole from clients to boost the revenues of the bank. They're going to fire you. So what's the point of stealing in the first place? Once I see myself as a bank manager and not as a bank owner, then my relationship to my own assets are very different. No point in stealing. Who am I stealing for? The balabos? He says don't steal. He says I'll fire you if you steal. I'll take it right back from you and I'll fire you. You won't have these assets to manage if you steal. The moment I begin to see myself as a trustee, as a manager of assets, and not as an owner of assets, I can begin to relate to the halachas of the Chush and Mishpat with a great deal more ease. It's not mine. We see that difference between trusteeship and ownership. Well, let's ask another question. Trusteeship for who? We see the difference in attitude there. Take the environmentalists. The environmentalists say that we are trustees of the world. We've got to look after it. We don't have the right to destroy the world. So the environmentalists are beginning to come close to a religious approach to assets. Right? The communists and the socialists also did in a funny way, and that's why Jewish idealists were attracted to it in the old days. Because they saw capitalism as stressing ownership, and they saw socialism as saying, no, money is here to be used for the good of the klal, for the good of the tzibur, and it has to be managed, it doesn't belong to anybody. And that's why young Jews, idealists, religious and non-religious, were attracted to the kibbutzim, and they were attracted to socialism, and they were attracted to communism in the old days. It sounded something idealistic. It was a way of relating to materialism in a more ideal sort of fashion, until they became disillusioned with it. And then communism started collapsing, and as communism and socialism started collapsing, environmentalism starts becoming powerful. And environmentalism is the next effort to find a moral relationship with assets. And what is that moral relationship? Trusteeship. You're here to look after it. It doesn't belong to you. You can't destroy the environment. You can't destroy the world. No matter how much money you can make out of it, it doesn't make any difference. You can't do that. You're a trustee. For whom are you a trustee according to the environmentalists? For the Ribbono Shel Olam? No. There's no Ribbono Shel Olam in the life of the environmentalists. For future generations. So it's an atheistic religion. That's what environmentalism is. And what would be the test? Very simple. What would the environmentalists have to say if all of a sudden the Mashiach arose, whether from New York or from Yerushalayim or wherever else, and the Beis HaMikdash was rebuilt, and we started bringing sacrifices, started bringing korbanos, and not the korban chatas and the other korbanos where something of it is eaten, but bring korban oilos. We take bulls and oxen and we shech them and we burn them to ashes on the Mizbeach. What would the environmentalists have to say about that? That wouldn't be acceptable. You're a trustee, you're not an owner. Sure, I'm a trustee, and the balabos told me to bring a sacrifice. No, he didn't. There's no balabos. We're balabos. Back to socialism. The world belongs to us. So the environmentalists are saying there is ownership of assets. There is an owner of the world. Who is the owner? We're all owners of the world. All the environmentalists are saying is, you're not an owner. We share it. Same as the communists. Not yours, it's ours too. That's a kind of theft. Making individual property belonging to the tzibur, except they've gone further. It doesn't belong to the state. It belongs to all of humanity, including future generations. It's communism to a greater extreme. It's socialism to a greater extreme. Communism and socialism simply said, that factory that you and your father sweated for to build doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the state. And the environmentalists say, that factory which you and your father sweated to build doesn't belong to you. It belongs to all of humanity. And to the future generations as well. That's who it belongs to. So in one sense, it's a coming closer to a religious recognition. On the other hand, it's the essence of atheism. You're right that it doesn't belong to me. Who does it belong to? The Ribbono Shel Olam. It doesn't belong to you, and it doesn't belong to humanity. It belongs to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And I am the manager. That's what we've got to be able to say, which is very different to environmentalism. The Barabos, the owner, is the manager. And he's given certain policies and guidelines by his board, which is the Ribbono Shel Olam, the chairman of his board, and that's how he has to function. I'm just a manager here. That's all. But it's not as if the world owns it. It's not as if future generation owns it. The Ribbono Shel Olam owns it. So if we look at those three schools of thought, capitalism says, I own what is mine. Socialism says, the state owns what is yours. Environmentalism says, humanity owns what is yours. And the Torah says, God owns what is yours. And your role is manager. You have an important role. The role that you have is manager. Then we can begin to relate to it. And that's the meaning of the Korban Oilah. And so the Medrash concludes, why is it called an Oilah? A rising sacrifice. Shehi el yoino mikola korbonis, because it's the highest of all sacrifices. Tedo misho yo mevi chatos hakoyin litlo. The chacham mincho. If a person brought a chatos or a korban mincho, the kohen used to take it. The zevach hashlemim lebaaleihim, ha'oshum the kohen. And the zevach shlemim used to be eaten by the owner. The oshum was eaten by the kohen. Aval ha'ilo, But the korban eilo ain beria toimi meno. No human being, no living being tastes of it. Ela kula eilo laKadosh Baruch Hu. Everything goes to Hashem, Shehu Elyon, who is the Most High. To realize that we take life itself, we take that animal, the most precious of assets. An animal, don't forget, in those days represented a business. An animal wasn't just an object. An animal was a source of income. We take our businesses, we take our source of income. That's what it's like. Imagine we were told, it's got to be a korban ola. What's the korban? Yeah, it's got to bring my dog, my cat, what must I bring? No, bring your business. How do you bring your business? Just destroy it all. Just burn it all. Take all the assets of your business and burn it. Because that's what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants. Imagine such a thing. That's what a korban ola is. Bring that cow, bring that ox, which is a source of income for you. It's not just one object, it's a source of ongoing income. And be ready, if that's what Hashem wants, to bring that as a sacrifice, to bring that as a korban olam. Because the Ribbono Shel Olam is the supreme master, he's the Baal HaBos, it belongs to him. Lekach nikra shma olam, that's why it's called a korban olam. And this enables us to understand two things finally. The one is, why not stealing is now considered an achievement. If a person says, I deserve a medal, why do you deserve a medal? The sacrifice which is brought for incorrect thought and linking that to theft, which is incorrect deed, more than incorrect thought. Normally we don't attach a wrong philosophy to theft. We don't look at a thief and say, we need to fix his philosophy. Well, you need to give him a jolly good hiding. That's what you need to do. He's naughty. We don't think that the philosophy, he knows you're not allowed to steal. Why is the korban connected to the issue of theft? When you see theft with the refinement that Chazal see it, and that Halacha sees it, that it's not just putting your hand in somebody else's tool, but it's the examples that we gave, anything which the Choshen Mishpat doesn't allow, these very subtle things are also called theft. Then we realize that the only way to escape those subtleties of theft is to have a philosophy where I see myself as manager and not as owner. And that's why if I don't see myself, if I haven't lived that way and I have stolen, it's because there's something wrong with the philosophy and it's linked to a korban olah. The korban olah represents that philosophy of understanding that even my source of income, my animals, can be destroyed for the Ribbono Shel Olam's sake, because he's the Baal HaBos. If that's what he wants me to do, that's what I must do. There's nothing, it doesn't belong to me, it doesn't belong to anybody else, it belongs to him. If he says bring it as a sacrifice, I'll bring it as a sacrifice. That's how Avraham brought himself to bring his son as a sacrifice, realizing that even a parent has trusteeship and not ownership. Who's the Baal HaBos? Hashem is the Baal HaBos. And if Hashem said give him back to me, I want him now, sacrifice him, she sacrifice him, that's all. I'm only a trustee, I'm working for you, and I take instructions from you. If we see it that way, it's easy, relatively, it's so to say, easy to be able to function that way. That's the korban olah, that's what the korban olah is. And that's the linkage of this most extreme example of secular ethics on the one hand, and this most extreme example of religious ritual on the other hand. Theft versus the korban olah, that brings Chazal to say that if you want to bring a korban and bikashta lahakrif korban, make sure that you've never taken anything that isn't yours according to the laws of the Shulchan Aruch, according to the laws of Choshen Mishpat. If you want to bring a korban in, bikashta lahakrif korban, lo sigzul lo odom klum. Make sure you haven't taken from anybody anything at all. Thank you.